welcome to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg on this final day of April.
And I am Matt Gillum, in for Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Very glad to be here on this hot summery day that is the final day of April.
I know you're loving it, mister. I'm from California.
I can't get enough of it. But before we talk about the heat, lots of stuff coming up today.
Yes, we're talking with two student reporters about the protests over the Israel-Gaza war on their campuses. They're students from Swarthmore and from University of Pennsylvania. They're student journalists looking forward to
it. Is everywhere in every big city, yeah. And it's even here in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia. I mean, and Drexel as well, I think, is also participating in this. We're seeing it everywhere. I mean, back home, UCLA, USC, taking two very different approaches to the demonstration. So we will check in with the students here and see how they are faring.
Also, former White House Social Secretary Deesha Dyer and a Philly native will be talking about overcoming imposter syndrome today on the show. Really enjoyed chatting with her.
I mean, that's got to be an amazingly stressful job.
Yes. And coming from Philly, she was a student at Community College of Philadelphia when her journey began. So, yeah, we'll be talking about imposter
syndrome.
That's
a rise. Yeah. That's an amazing rise.
And I know our third segment is one close to your heart.
I mean, what can I say? Yes, we are talking about the art of great cocktails. We've got
two brother
bartenders. They are coming in. They are going to talk to us about summer drinking trends and, you know, hey, samples. What's wrong with that at, you know, the noon hour on a Tuesday?
You know, that's one of the reasons why I love my job. You know, and Cinco de Mayo is coming up. So we got a lot of things to talk about. If you have questions about cocktails, what you should have in your bar, whatever, email us studio2@whyy.org and we will pose your questions to our bartender brothers.
Exactly.
Today.
And you can also give us a call. 888-477-9499 is the number.
And so it's hot out. I know you're really happy about that. And you made a new discovery since you've been in Philadelphia.
I am learning about the local things here in Philadelphia. And I got to say, water ice is one of my favorite summer treats.
And pause. Kudos to you for saying it correctly. Water ice.
Slowly developing an accent. I saw some people a month or so ago when it was like, you know, warm and in the 70s and they were getting the water ice. And I thought, this is a weird, too early, not quite right. But this past weekend, it was in like the mid 80s. It was humid. It was hot. Mm-hmm. It was sunny. Felt like summer. And I'm walking by and I just let you know, now's the time. Just go have the water ice. Treat yourself.
And I will tell you this, our conversation about this, you were surprised about the consistency, how the flavor is just sort of infused into the ice, something you're not used to on the West Coast.
It's this magical fusion that's like not it's better than shave ice.
Ooh.
But it's like not a slushy. It's this happy middle ground where the magic snow is like flavored magic snow and it doesn't drip out of the snow.
Yes, and mark my word, Matt Gillum, I told you this is the magical time of Philadelphia. May 1st is tomorrow. It is a beautiful time when the weather warms, everybody's smiling. Water ice is not free usually, but you might find it free on occasion. This is the magic of the city.
All right, I've waxed poetic about this discovery,
yes.
But quickly, you are Queen Gelati, I hear.
Yes, I like a little bit of, you know, custard on the bottom and on the top with water ice in the middle. Cherry. Water ice.
Cherry for cherry. There
yes,
we go.
That's right. It's delicious. So tens of thousands of people are expected to take part in the Broad Street Run this weekend. Another Philadelphia fave, your first one. You'll be watching.
Raging
it.
Athlete, yeah. That you know I am.
And it marked in my mind that the warm weather start of the running season is upon us. But you may look around to see how many young people are running the race, because apparently long runs, marathons to be exact, are a milestone for the quarter life crisis. Did you know this?
I mean, it's a thing. I did not know that marathon running had become an aspect of the quarter life crisis. But I mean, yes, that is definitely a thing. I mean, you're young, you're out of school, maybe you're at the first grown up job, you've got the bills. Student debt these days.
It's coming out.
Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it is a very uncertain time in your life when you're like 24 mm-hmm. and you kind of have it together a little bit, but still
not
so
really.
Much.
Well,
ahead.
These Gen Zs and baby millennials, they're all over TikTok.
Baby millennials.
Yeah. And they're like showing themselves signing up for marathons, training for marathons, running marathons. And no need for someone to tell me that the Broad Street Run is not a marathon, because I do know that. But it is something that people use to train for longer runs. So, you know, sometimes you have to qualify and all these things. So you got to get your runs in. And so the numbers apparently are showing that there is this trend.
No, the numbers aren't lying.
The Atlantic did a whole article on it, and it shows that it's trending up when it comes to people in their 20s.
In 2019, 15% of people who ran the New York Marathon were in their 20s. Now that is nearly 20% as of 2023. Same thing, the LA Marathon, up to 28% of 20-somethings. So, this is becoming a thing, and I'm not a runner, so good for them, but whatever.
In my quarter crisis, I took up spinning and kickboxing, so there you go. So we got to go to our third and final story about this.
All right, this one. I love this. I love a good animal story. Pennsylvania's most famous and only, the words are about to come out of my mouth, emotional support alligator. Let it wash over you. Emotional support alligator is missing.
Wow.
Yeah. There's a gator napping afoot. Wally, the alligator, who lives in Jonestown with his owner, Joey Henney, was stolen from his pen in Georgia while they were visiting friends there. Now, he's been gone since April 21st. That's when he was taken from the enclosure. He was apparently dropped off into someone's yard. And then that person called the Department of Conservation and Natural Resources, which had a trapper come. And then the trapper took Wally to a swamp and deposited him with more than a dozen, perhaps, other gators.
Oh, so it's going to be hard to identify Wally at this point. That's sad. What I did like about this story was the outpouring of support from TikTokers offering to come help find Wally. And you never know.
Let's all keep our fingers crossed for Wally, because, I mean, nothing beats that picture of him being held up by Gritty.
Yeah. Oh, but we're going to go to our newsmaker now. Student protests over the Israel-Hamas war are spreading at college campuses nationwide, including many institutions in our region. Encampments have sprung up at the University of Pennsylvania, Drexel, Swarthmore, and Haverford College, among others. And things are escalating. Columbia University is suspending students who refuse to disband, and a number of students have been arrested at other schools, including at Princeton.
Well, for administrators, Israel's war against Hamas and America's role in the conflict has presented a very big challenge. And many Jewish students have said that the demonstrations have resulted in a rise in anti-Semitism and are making them feel unsafe. To find out more about how the protests are playing out on local campuses, we spoke with two student reporters earlier this morning. Jared Mitovich is the editor-in-chief for University of Pennsylvania's The Daily Pennsylvanian, and Melanie Zell is managing editor for Swarthmore College's The Phoenix. We started our conversation with Jared and getting Melanie and Jared's response to growing protests across the country.
It feels like a watershed moment for student activism on college campuses. I think you've just seen this kind of bubbling up like throughout the year. It's not just like a one and done thing that happened to start like 2 weeks ago with Columbia, but this has been part of a wave of pro-Palestinian activism. And frankly, these students feel like their voices have not been responded to by university administrators. And that's really led to what we're seeing right now with just increasingly, deliberative like protests on campuses.
Melanie, any reaction to this?
Yeah, I gotta agree. At Swarthmore, you know, this is not the first sit-in even this year on the issue of Palestine. And I think when these universities bring in militarized police forces, it shouldn't surprise them that the tenor of protests gets more and more militant.
All right, well, let's zoom in on your respective campuses. Jared, tell us what the mood is like in the encampment at Penn. I mean, is it tense? Is it optimistic? Is it open to a dialogue? How are students there feeling?
Yeah, so I'd say it's pretty quiet today. I think the administration's actually been pretty silent for the past 3 days. On I think it was Friday night, they issued an order for the encampment to disband due to alleged open expression, legal and policy violations. But the encampment's still there 3 days later, and I think, you know, students are just kind of waiting to see what's happening next. They're holding programming on the Palestinian cause. They're educating one another. Obviously, they're sleeping over in the tents, engaging with faculty. But there is a heightened administration presence in the last 24 hours, I would say. So my understanding is there's certainly some sort of conversation ongoing about, you know, how they can potentially reach a resolution here. I'm not sure what that might look like.
Yeah, I was wondering, what do they want?
So the students who are camping out on College Green want three things. They want Penn's divestment from companies involved in Israel's war in Gaza. They want the defense of Palestinian students, and they otherwise just want to see the disclosure of all of the university's investments. They want to know, what is my school investing in, what companies, and like from there they want to understand like how is that connected to the alleged Israel human rights violations and the Palestinian occupation.
Well, Melanie, similar demands from students at Swarthmore or a mood of resolve in the camp there? Tell us about the situation unfolding on your campus.
Yeah, well, at Swarthmore, the mood, I think, has been a little bit more optimistic, a little bit more positive. It's not been characterized by the sorts of confrontational, you know, yelling matches that we've seen in viral videos from other campuses. And I think part of that is that it's a smaller community. You know, it's in the Philadelphia suburbs. And so there hasn't been as much attention. So the general tone is a little bit lower. I will say, however, the demands are similar, with the one exception that students are also demanding a recognition of what they call scholasticide, which is Israel's alleged targeting of academic institutions and like professors and students in Gaza.
Very interesting. Melanie, follow up. How long has the protest been going on at Swarthmore? Because I know that at Penn, this has been going on for months, even before October 7th. So when was sort of the development point at Swarthmore?
Well, this current encampment was erected on Monday the 22nd, but we've seen protests throughout the year on this. There's been walkouts. And as I referenced earlier, there was a sit-in at the end of last semester in the main administrative building for the last couple weeks of the semester. Now, that sort of petered out and didn't really end in much of a resolution. Folks just sort of went home for a break. But there's generally been a sense of unrest and protest on campus all year.
Yeah. And how are the Jewish students, Jared, how are they reacting to this? Because there's been counter-protest to that encampment.
Indeed, yeah. I mean, it's hard to ascribe any community on campus to a monolith. I mean, Penn's such a large community. So you do see some Jewish students participating in the encampment or otherwise supporting the cause. At the same time, there have been some pretty fervent counter-protests, including on Sunday. There was a rally and then a march to the encampment where there was basically like a barricade separating like the encampment organizers and those protesters and the pro-Israeli protesters. So a lot of shouting back and forth, all peaceful, all quiet, but just generally like you can see that there's this division among campus, among who supports which cause and like how they agree about how to properly demonstrate. And I think in the past few days, you've certainly seen the swelling of criticism from not only Jewish students, but parents and some alumni of their perceived anti-Semitism and some of the occurrences at the encampment. And that's something that I think the administration is considering, especially in light of what happened last semester on our campus, where our president essentially resigned for very similar reasons of how she handled those kinds of things.
Well, we've seen encampments attempts to clear them out. We've seen arrests made. Mm-hmm. I'm curious what are the Penn demonstrators prepared to do? I guess are they ready to take that step and be arrested should it come to that?
Yes, I would say they've gone under arrest training, legal training. They're prepared for that possibility. You know, they've kind of separated into several groups: students who are willing to be arrested, students who would stay behind, and so on. And they've kind of kept like a pretty organized approach to this. Whether that actually happens remains to be seen. We're entering day six without any significant interruption beyond a fire marshal sweep for fire safety purposes. I think you can certainly see that the university is trying to list examples of like how they think the encampment is like approaching things and like why they think the encampment might need to disband, like so that they can justify potential escalation later on.
Were you able to get a sense or speak to any of the protesters after yesterday? We heard that the Philly District Attorney Larry Krasner, he said he was unsure if he'd be prosecuting campus demonstrators and he'd be taking them on a case by case basis. Did that hearten them? Did they have a response to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're only emboldened by the prospect of university action. I think they're very dedicated to their cause, and they're not going to back down from that very easily without the university coming to the table with something. Whether there's disciplinary action involved kind of remains to be seen. But, you know, the administration has said that they're violating open expression policies. So to me, it's only a matter of time before you see some sort of escalation on at least the policy or discipline front.
And Melanie, I want to bring you back into the conversation. What has been Swarthmore's response? Do you see escalation? Are there any safety concerns on the campus?
Yeah, well, Swarthmore has not had nearly the same police presence as other encampments have. However, the administration has been far from supportive or even tolerant. They've put out statements condemning the protest. Early yesterday morning, they removed a structure from the encampment that they said was dangerous to students. And they've also said that they're going to be investigating participation in the encampment as part of investigations that were launched as part of last semester's sit-in. Now, it's unclear what those investigations would be into. They haven't named specific code of conduct violations. And it's part of a larger sort of sense of vague surveillance that I think has really put a damper on the otherwise free and open atmosphere on campus.
And quick follow-up to you, Melanie, you mentioned that this was a more collegial, you know, gathering of students. Any concerns by Jewish students feeling unsafe or any counter-protest at all?
Sure. Well, by no means does this current protest have the support of all of the students at Swarthmore, but we haven't seen the same sort of dedicated counter-protests. We haven't seen any student groups releasing statements in opposition to it. You know, our paper, The Phoenix, has reached out to a lot of organizations. We've been engaged with the community, and we really haven't gotten the sense that there's a mobilized opposition.
Yeah.
Well, Melanie, you said that you know, there is a fraction of the students that are very involved in this, dedicated, and there are some that aren't. So I'm curious, what are the students that are just on campus trying to wrap up the semester, getting ready to perhaps graduate, go home for summer, take a job, whatever? How are they feeling about all of this sort of culminating at the end of their academic year?
Well, I think most students are ambivalent or in support in theory, but not willing to risk their academic career. That's been generally my sense from talking to people. But generally, the mood on the lawn is light. People sort of filter in and out. There aren't barricades up, so it really is like, as much as there is an encampment on the green, it's still being used like a college green would. People playing frisbee, reading books, talking to each other, holding class.
Well, Jared, what about Penn? Because I mean, the mood seems different, and I've also heard that events are already being sort of moved around at the end of the year. Tell us about what's happening.
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely echo the ambivalence or the support for the cause, but not a willingness to participate in the encampment. I would say on College Green itself, at least from what I've seen walking by, you're pretty much only seeing the encampment as the main center of activity there. You know, take a step back to the high-rise field, which is a little bit across campus. You're seeing that kind of like enjoying the summer weather, the frisbee activity that you might usually see there. In terms of events, we are seeing the moving of certain like sophomore and junior traditions. So there's one tonight that was scheduled to be held on College Green, celebrating sophomores going to their upperclassmen years. That's been moved to high-rise field, and we're still waiting to see what will happen there. But overall, you're seeing like decent amounts of support from members of the faculty and just like the student overall, even if they're not participating in the encampment, not to mention Philadelphia community members.
And this is graduation season. I mean, do you predict that this will disrupt graduation festivities? And how long, realistically, do you think these protests will last? Because like Matt said, people just want to go home and get to their summer, right?
It's really hard to say. To be honest, I'm waiting to see kind of just what happens with the other encampments on other college campuses. Like, I don't think Penn is the school that's going to set the precedent for their approach to this. I think they're going to try to see what works, and that speaks to just how many of these encampments there are. I could certainly see it continuing until commencement, but I'm not sure if there's like a disruption planned or anything. But I think either way, everybody commit that there's like a heightened level of activism. I'm absolutely certain that administration is preparing for that possibility right now.
And same question to you, Melanie. Do you think this will sort of, as we get closer to commencement time, that this will sort of peter out?
You know, I think it's too early to say. I will note that at Swarthmore, the encampment is currently on the lawn that is usually used for encampment or for graduation. So it'll be interesting to see if the school moves in closer to that date to try to clear things up so that those ceremonies can go forward. But right now, it's just too far away.
Well, we have been speaking to Melanie Zell, managing editor of the Swarthmore Phoenix, and Jared Midovich, editor-in-chief of the University of Pennsylvania's The Daily Pennsylvanian. Thank you so much for being here with us and sharing what's going on with your campuses.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we will be watching, Matt, you know, as protests continue over the next few days.
No, it is developing and unfolding. And this is day six there on Penn. And who knows how long this is going to go.
Yeah, fingers crossed that people who worked hard and can graduate, you know, to graduate, exactly. can graduate. So we have a lot more left of the show coming up. An interview with former White House Social Secretary and Philly native Deesha Dyer. Looking forward to that.
Stay with us.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Matt Gillum.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. The social secretary of the White House is probably one of the biggest event planning jobs in the world. Hosting prime ministers, the Pope, and royalty. It takes charisma, out of this world organizational skills, and talent to do that job. Or dare I say, Matt, it's a Philly thing.
Well, Deesha Dyer, a Philly native and a graduate of the Community College of Philadelphia, brought some Philly flavor and flair to the Obama White House. It took some time for her to overcome internalized fear about not being good enough for that prestigious job. And she talked to you, Cherry, about overcoming imposter syndrome and why she thought that now, 7 years after leaving the White House, was the right time to write a book about her time with the Obamas.
It took me a while to even, you know, even reconcile or even reflect on what happened, that I worked in the White House for all those years. I couldn't get the words out, some of the experiences and all of that. But as I speak around the country, around imposter syndrome, around people not believing in themselves, it's way more prevalent than what we think it is. And it's affecting a lot of mental health and mental awareness, especially in young women, Black women. So for me, the timing just added up with all the stuff going on in the country, people wanting to like figure out, you know, how can I, you know, do better? How can I feel more deserving or worthy? That lined up with like, oh my gosh, I had this amazing experience and now I can write about it. So I felt like it was the time for me to do that. And because I'm relatable and I'm, you know, a down home girl. So I think people look at my book and they look at my story and they're just like, I see myself in that. And then that is what motivates them and inspires them.
Yeah, I definitely saw some of those moments. I want to sort of have you read an excerpt from your book to set the scene.
Yes, yes. I was 31 years old. On my second attempt at college after a failed first attempt at 17. I now had only 12 college credits to my name. I'm not even sure exactly what made me think I would be actually chosen. I had an eviction on my record and terrible credit. I'd written about a past abortion in the newspaper, and I didn't have any connections to politics. Unlike some who'd been active in government since college or had family members who held positions in Washington. There was no political legacy in my bloodline or lifeline, which, as it turned out, was a good thing. I had a resume full of unexpected detours. I hadn't applied for the internship in the hope that I'd get it, but I'd been curious enough to try.
So I love this excerpt from your book. To me, it was very revealing of your true self. Throughout this book, you talk about imposter syndrome, but there's this tension because you have this uncanny belief in yourself at the same time. So I want you to explain what imposter syndrome means to you.
Right. I would say that now imposter syndrome means to me is more of an oppressive term of illusion of making me think I was not worthy. It's really a sham in the sense of who's holding the puppet strings, who said you're not worthy. So to me now, that's the way I feel. I feel like it is something that kept and held me back that was not my fault or responsibility or feeling undeserving. back then, from the excerpt I just read, I felt as if imposter syndrome was the thing that was my fault. Like, I wasn't qualified. I was a fraud. I wasn't supposed to be there. So I've evolved a lot since, you know, reading, you know, going through that at 31 to where I am now. And so imposter syndrome, unfortunately for a lot of people, is still at the place in which I was, where they were just like, I don't know if I belong here. I don't know if I'm smart enough. But it's also these systems are at play of keeping us feeling that way. And when you think about it, it's like, no, I'm qualified. No, I'm deserving, and I'm definitely worthy, and I'm of value. And that was an evolution that I had to come to, which that's where I am now. So that's what the book takes us through.
That's a beautiful thing. And by the way, this excerpt comes just after the moment that you found out that you got the internship and that you would be one of the White House interns.
Yes, yes, in 2009.
Yeah, as a student at Community College of Philadelphia. And then the book sort of, you talk about the root cause. Where did this imposter syndrome thing, this self-doubt, this, where did it come from?
I believe for me, I think, you know, everybody's different, but I believe for me, it came from probably a child. You know, I was a very loud child. I always questioned things. And I believe that my voice was very stifled in many ways of saying, you're too loud. You're too bold. It wasn't you're a leader. It wasn't that let's figure out how to use your voice for good things. It was, you know, kind of go in the corner and make yourself unknown. And so I feel like when that kept happening to me over time, from whether it was teachers, administrators, own family, I started to believe to myself, well, I'm not worthy. Like, I should be in the corner. Like, that's where I should be. That's my deserving place, not out front. And my voice is too loud. I put everything on myself. And so I think a lot of it was, you know, upbringing. And, you know, I wasn't raised with my parents. I was raised at a boarding school. And I think that there was just not an outlet like we have now for, you know, for women, young women or girls to be like, stand up, you know, be strong. I didn't have all that. So I got quiet down. You know, you're disrespectful. You have an attitude. And so all those things, I believe, is where it came from. So I had to go back and dig up the root of where it came from in order to heal.
Yeah. And by the way, you're from Philadelphia.
Yes.
Both your parents were in your life and they applied for you to go to the Milton Hershey School, which is this boarding school in Hershey, Pennsylvania. I've been there before.
Yes.
Beautiful school. Mm-hmm. You know, for kids who come from low income families, it's a big opportunity for a lot of kids. But while you were there, that is sort of where they said, you talk too much. You were always in trouble.
Always.
And I can't even meet it. We got a chance to talk a little bit off mic. But Deesha, I can't imagine you always in trouble, girl.
Always. I was always. I wasn't really in trouble. I went to Milton Hershey School in fifth grade. I didn't really get in trouble till ninth grade. Like
okay.
In ninth
so you
grade,
were good. You
I was
stayed
good.
Out of trouble.
I was
the
in the same student home. Got to ninth grade, and I think it was just everything from adolescence to hormones. I mean, everything's changing in a young woman's life at 13, 14. And that's when I really started to be like, no, I don't think this is right, or I don't like this rule. I mean, it was partially, you know, defiance, right? And then the other part was really much like, I'm just going to stand up for what I think is right.
And then you went to college.
I did.
Dropped out. It was expensive. Understood. You became a freelance journalist right here in the Philadelphia area. Worked at a real estate company. Eventually went to Community College of Philadelphia. What made you say, I'm going to apply for this White House internship program?
I mean, I think really for me, Barack Obama had captivated so much of the country, including myself. There was this big wave of hope and change and electricity really in our city, but across the country. I had never really, you know, been into politics that much. And I was very mesmerized by what was happening. It was kind of like this black man was, you know, catapulted to this, you know, this national stage. And he, you know, talked about things in our community, and it just gripped me really. And so I think that I always thought I was very involved in community here in Philadelphia. I was like, he just has to meet me. And they're like, if he meets me, he will see my dedication to the people and, you know, hire me.
I
mean, I think made up a lot of fantasies as a kid. Like if so-and-so Oprah just met me, she would, you know, be like, this girl's amazing. And not like in my head, like not ever thinking these things would happen. And I think I applied because I went into it reading the application, you know, being like, I know that I won't be qualified because there's probably an age requirement. There's probably a school requirement. There's probably a money or a political, some kind of connection. And there wasn't. So that to me was like a sign being like, okay, all you have to do is write an essay and like fill this application.
And you like, I got that because I'm a writer, right?
I can write an essay. This is no problem. And so for me, I think that I just did it being like, we'll just see what happens. I can't recall the moment in which I really had the confidence to press send. Like it was one of these, like, I just did it and it's out of my hands and like, you know, we'll see what happens. And it was, you know, a miracle that it ended up like where I catapulted.
And that's what fascinates me about mm-hmm. you, Deesha, because mm-hmm. on one hand you have this self-deprecation, like I'm not good enough, da da da, but then you have this courage and the audacity to be like, well, maybe I am.
Yeah.
How did you sort of deal with yourself in the sense, these are two sides of yourself. Mm-hmm. It's like two versions of yourself, one on each shoulder fighting.
Yeah, definitely. And that's the perfect way to put it, actually. I think that for me, most of it was because I'd grown up being a fighter. Like, I'm always a fighter. I'm always defensive. I'm always ready to, like, you know, push buttons. And so I think that when I applied for the internship, it was almost pushing the buttons of the other shoulder, being like, you know, you said I can't do it, but I can do it, or I can try.
I want you to read the second excerpt.
Yes. Being the White House social secretary was the biggest job of my career. And I knew that in order to survive, I had to hold tight to pieces of me that wouldn't budge. I was aware that this could garner me a reputation, one that I still carry. A reputation that confirms what the world thinks of Black women in general. No matter how many degrees we hold, promotions we obtain, or problems we solve. This reputation is that we are combative, not a team player, and difficult.
So I have two questions from this.
Yes.
First question is, what part of yourself did you hold dear? Did you not let anyone change?
My community, I think community and culture. There was not a compromise on that. There was not a, you know, when we had something at the White House, there was not a time where I didn't say, let's bring different people in. Let's try this. Let's like make sure I'm like bringing in everybody from Philadelphia, from choirs to DJs to like school teachers. I think that I held very closely to community and culture, not just from the city I'm from, but just like being Black or being a woman or, you know, just even education, just making sure that we have representation. We had education conferences from community college.
So I got to ask you, what's your favorite story? Because I know you met the Pope. You met lots of famous people.
Yeah.
What's your favorite one?
I have a lot of really great stories, but I would say the one of the best has a Philly story where we weren't really supposed to take a lot of pictures. Like, we didn't take a lot of pictures. I don't have a lot of pictures from my time there. And one of our last parties, we had the Roots and then we had Bradley Cooper there. And
Philly,
I was like,
people.
This is a Philly moment. And I was like, it was October of 2016. And I kept saying, like, they ain't gonna fire me. Our jobs are over in January. Like, I'm getting this picture. And I took a picture. And I remember, and the picture was blurry because I was rushing. And we were all standing there just talking about Philly. And I was like, I cannot believe I'm sitting here with like the Roots, which I know is a Square Roots, and Bradley Cooper talking about Philadelphia. Like, it was like we were all just partying. It was like a moment, you know. So that's one of my favorite like Philly affiliated stories.
I love that story that Deesha had, Matt, about Philadelphia and her comments about, you know, imposter syndrome resonates to so many.
I mean, a lot of people I know have struggled with that, but she clearly overcame and had an amazing journey that took her all the way to the White House.
And now with a brand new book. So there you go. Yeah.
Well, that sounded great. And Sherry, coming up for us, we are going to keep the focus on being social along with a good conversation. The other essential for a hit cocktail party is the drinks. We've got two bartending brothers coming into the studio to help us chart summer sipping with cocktail and mocktail recipes. So stay thirsty and stick with us.
All right.
Hi. Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Matt Gillum.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. It's another beautiful and hot day outside, Matt. And let me tell you, I am ready to set up my rooftop deck at the new place and have some friends over, living my best life, Philly style, on a early, or I say spring evening. Yeah, because we're not summer yet.
It's only going to get warmer, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, nothing beats a good rooftop bar. I live by that that expression. And, you know, I also have a fairly decent bar cart at my place, Cherry, and it's feeling like it might be time to switch from some of the heavier and darker drinks to lighter, possibly even fizzier fare.
Fizzy. I like it.
And since I knew I'd be filling in for Avi, I wanted to have some Philly bartenders on the show to get their insights on early summertime tippling.
And who did you find?
Well, Cherry, with us here in Studio 2 are Damien and Diego Langarica. They are award-winning bartenders in Philly. Damien works at Irwin's on the 8th floor of the Bock Building in South Philly. Diego does double duty tending bar at the Franklin Mortgage on the weekends, as well as a bar in Rittenhouse Square. They both come from Spain, and they both know their way around the liquor cabinet. Damien and Diego, welcome. Very glad to have you here.
Hi, guys.
Thank you, guys. Thank you for having us.
So tell us a little bit about your background and how you ended up, you know, coming from Spain to Philadelphia.
Well, for me, it was...
this is Diego, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. First, after pandemic, I got a call from my brother, and he was like, hey, you want to come work with me in Philadelphia? And I was like, sure, that'll be fine. And it was supposed to be for like a year, and then 3 years later, I'm still here and enjoying the city.
I love it.
All right, so, Damien, you what's your Philly story?
For me, I moved like about 11 years ago now. I was in the suburbs of PA first, and then I moved to Philly about 7 years ago. Just fell in love with the city and the industry as well, and the camaraderie in the bar industry in Philly. So I just stood over here for the long time.
So give us some of your street cred behind the bar. Like, tell us why you love bartending, and do you have, like, an aesthetic or something?
I think we got into this just out of coincidence. Like, I wasn't looking to get into this, but I started working in the restaurant with my brother and my dad. And then I sort of fell into, like, wanted to know more about the bar scene, spirits, mm-hmm. and cocktails in general. So I kind of like got into internet, watched some videos, learned about how you can make a career out of this, and not just bartend and as like a side gig or something like that. And then decided to dig into it, started competing local level, national level, and this is where I am now.
Well, tell us what you won.
I haven't won much, but I have got pretty much in a bunch of them. What I tell people is like it's not about winning. What I like about this competition is like you go all the places. And you meet other people and other bartenders from across the country.
Yeah.
And you learn from them, you network for them. So you kind of like, you know, like I said, like your network is your network. So you kind of grow as a bartender that way. You learn more from other people from like, I don't know, San Francisco or like New York or Miami or like, I don't know, the Midwest. So that's why I got into it. That's why I love it.
All right. So Diego, what are some of the trends that you're seeing? And you both are sort of helping us to create trends in Philly, right?
Yeah. I mean, right now, the trends of like cocktails wise, I will say there's a few cocktails that are like most popular, the classics, and people are taking like riff from them. Definitely the espresso martinis.
Mm.
They're like popular, they've been popular. And right now, martinis. I feel like there's a lot of...
This sounds like me.
Yeah. It's one of the things that right now I feel like people are playing a lot with martinis, going a little more outside of the classic cocktail, like dirty or dry martini, which is, I think, is pretty cool. And even myself, I'm like working on that right now. So, yeah, those are the trends that I see right now.
What about in terms of spirits or anything? What's hot right now?
Tequila.
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 I got it.
Mezcal.
I love it.
Mezcal.
Yeah. Which I love it. I can't complain about it. It's great spirit.
Cocktails, martinis, spirits. Tequila. So we have drinks in front of us, and I'm looking. My eyes are going to.
We have a range of small bottles that the brothers have brought,
and some of them have a little color to them, and I'm loving that. So let's try to pick one and describe it for our listeners.
Start us through the tasting.
Of course. So what we're going to give you guys to try is something that we have at the Irwin's Mirror right now. It's called the Fiore di Sicilia. So it's a white Negroni rift where it's, instead of gin, it's grappa base, which is grappa is a spirit made out of pomace from the winemaking. So the leftover wine, they distill it, so that's grappa. A similar spirit to Campari, but clear, so a bitter orange liqueur. And then we infuse a Bianco vermouth with toasted almonds and orange bitters.
So toasted almonds?
Yeah, so it's very floral, nutty, very summery vibes. You know, like still bitter, but not as much, I guess. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what
this,
we have.
This sounds like a great rooftop hot day drink.
Yeah, exactly.
And so who is this sort of for as you pour on this? Is this sort of when someone comes up to the bar and they're like, they're like, I don't know, you know, what to order. Who would you give this to? What kind of person would you say, oh, do you like sweet, sour? Like, what questions would
I
you
think
ask
to figure that out? If you're looking, I would give this to anybody, like, if you like Negronis, if you like that bitter, but you want mm-hmm. something, or you're like, I heard about Negroni, but like, I don't like that bitterness. Like, but you want to get into that type of flavor, I will start with this.
This is like a gateway.
Yeah, this is like a build-up.
It's a gateway drink. I like it.
It's like the entry level. It's like, you like Negronis, you like bitter, but you're afraid of that. If you're not going to like it, I will start with this. This is kind of what I would recommend to somebody like that.
Okay.
Do a lot of people come in indecisive and rely on you to guide them, or do they know what they want?
Kind of.
Yes.
Yeah, a lot of people is like, oh, I don't know what you get on the menu. Like, I'm confused. So, I mean, that's our job, not to, like, guide them through the menu. And how I start to the conversation with the customer is, what do you like to drink? What do you normally drink? Or what are you in the mood for right now? Mm-hmm. And then, depends on what they say, I can, you know, guide them to the menu and recommend different cocktails.
All right, let's try this Negroni.
Over here. Yeah. Ooh, they're putting in ice.
We're getting some ice. We're stirring. Yes. This is a full on session mm-hmm. happening here.
They're being mixed. You can hear that. I like the little
stirring.
I don't think I ever heard myself stirring a drink.
but on radio, that's how you have drinks on the radio.
It's pretty fun.
Awesome.
That's how people know what's happening.
Yeah. Yep. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Am I supposed to take a whiff first?
Let's smell.
Yeah.
It smells very citrusy.
Mm-hmm. It's about to tell people. It's your drink. Drink out whatever you want.
I can taste the little almond.
Yeah.
It has that. I can taste that nutty. Mm.
I'm just like blown away by the clarity, but also like the Campari punch of the bitterness in there. This is fantastic.
Like, it's a drink that by the looks of it, you don't expect it to be like nutty or like mm-mm. you know, rich. You expect it to be light floral, but it's like you take a sip and you're like, oh, wait a minute.
It's toasty.
Yeah,
it is That is a good word for this. This is very toasty, and it's
counterintuitive for a fresh drink.
As you drink it, there's a fragrance that goes in. It's mm-hmm. very fragrant and tasty. This is good. This is delicious. I would order this on a Tuesday night.
Come see us. Come see us.
Yes. And so you mentioned...
Remind us what this one is called again.
So that is called the Fiore di Sicilia.
Fiore di Sicilia.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So Irwin's is a Sicilian restaurant. Not just telling you, just focus on Sicilian food. So we're trying to replicate and showcase those flavors from Sicily. So this is kind of like an homage to that.
Oh. Sicily tastes good.
And what type of glass would this be served in?
That will be on the rocks.
So this would be on the rocks like a regular mm-hmm. like cocktail glass. Okay.
We are loath to say. I'm going to expose us. We have plastic cups in the studio right now. And yes, it did bother me.
And I was like, I wonder what kind of glass would I... And so I could make this at home.
Yeah.
But not really.
I mean, I'll give you the recipe. You can make it for sure.
But
Jerry, are you going to be toasting some almonds?
No, but this is something that you probably would... want to go to a bar for because of the toasted almond part.
And the infusion, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's not super complicated. Like, if you want to spend the time, then you can make it. Everybody mm-hmm. can make it. It's not super crazy. It's been difficult.
Okay. And so as you pour the second drink, I want to give you a question about from Damien. Hannah emails, I have a big party coming up with 20 guests. Can I make a group-sized cocktail in a pitcher, or do I have to make individual drinks? And I got to throw this out, too, because... this is my issue, because you put the ice in there, you have to put the ice on the side because you're making this big picture of drinks. Yeah. Your advice, what can she make?
I think the easiest way for a party like that, is like, I always recommend punches. Mm. Like, make a punch. Mm-hmm. You know, get creative. Instead of diluting it with water, dilute it with a tea or some sort of distraction like that. Mm. So you can add another layer of flavor. But I recommend punches. as like a volume cocktail for 20 people. If you don't want to be shaking cocktails, no back and forth, I would say go with a punch. Pre-batch it, add a ice to it, and then scoop it out and serve.
I mean, punch can be complex or can be really easy. Just a couple of bottles of something and some juice, right?
Some juice, some syrup, some tea if you want to add extra flavor to it, and then go for it.
Go for it. If you have a...
Some bubbles.
If you have a question that you want to get it in now. The email is studio2@whyy.org. Okay, Diego, pour the other drink.
Diego, what do we got going on now?
So this is a drink that we have at a Franklin Mortgage. This is our way to make a Bloody Mary. It's called the Attack of the Killer Gosley Tomatoes. So this drink, we made a gazpacho.
This is a which is slight and light yellowy flavor in your color, and you're saying this is a Bloody Mary riff.
Yes.
Wow. Okay.
That's the ghostly part. So what we did here was we did a gazpacho, which is a Spanish cold soup made out of tomatoes, cucumber, peppers, and then we make the soup. We take the water out of the soup, and that's gonna be our tomato flavor. And then we add a little bit of vodka, dry vermouth, and fino sherry. And yeah, it's a very low ABV cocktail, very light.
And
a little,
this little
garnish.
A little thyme.
Oh, a little
spring
thyme.
As a garnish.
It's fragrant.
Yeah, it smells very fresh.
You can smell the vegetable.
Vegetal. Planty. One of my favorite ones.
Wow, it has a saltiness to it.
Yeah.
And now I can see the riff on the Bloody Mary with
curiously savory,
the ghostly Bloody Mary. I love that. That is such a good play on words. You can taste the tomato.
Yeah.
It's a little salty. It is savory. And I feel like the flavor gets fuller after you drink. Like it just sort of like
it's good after
it's
it
good
goes
after
down.
It goes down.
Yeah.
that's a good way of saying that.
No, but also this is not a traditional Bloody Mary in that I would not want this to be reviving myself the next day. This would be on the night out.
On the night out,
I think it's a great cocktail to like start the night.
Excellent
it.
Point.
And you go
yes.
Out.
Mm-hmm. And, just keep dialing it up.
And while we pour the third one, I have a question. Cinco de Mayo's coming up. Got to ask you about good way to celebrate. How do you make a great margarita that isn't like basic with the margarita stuff that you buy from the grocery store?
I guess for me, what is important on a margarita has obviously a great tequila or either mezcal. I like mezcal personally. Mm-hmm. But also have to like the juice, the lime juice. It has to be like, you know,
fresh
lime juice. That's very important. And a little bit of agave. I think margaritas are a very like simple cocktail, but I think it's more on like where the components of the margarita, like having like fresh lime juice, a good agave syrup, and then a good tequila or mezcal.
So the quality ingredients is what makes a margarita.
Yeah.
I love that. And so explain this last one.
Well, coming up, we've got a mocktail, right? Because some people are not imbibing.
Yeah, they live that sober life. But you could live that sober life and still be...
So we don't have a mocktail. We have something else.
Oh! Yeah. Out of left field. The brothers are blowing our minds
so
now.
So what he made now, that was a Franklin cocktail. This is something he's making that's currently at the A-Bar menu. Just for this week, correct?
Yes. So we have a thing at A-Bar. It's called Down to the Rabbit Hole. And every last week of the month, we have a new menu with four cocktails. Each month, it's going to be a different theme. This month, we have highballs.
Mm.
So we make four highballs. And this one over here, which is my favorite one, what we have here is... I have it made with Mediterranean gin infused with figs. We also put a liqueur made out of whiskey, scotch, and honey called Rambu. Yogurt whey, lemon cordial, and topped with club soda.
I think this is my favorite one.
I mean, I'm intrigued. You said yogurt whey?
Yes.
All right.
It has a creamy taste, and that's kind of what I like. Ooh. And it has bubbles, which I really, really like.
This is all over the place. There's like milky mouth feel, but the bubbles, but it's all working somehow.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites right now.
And it smells light, and it smells, has like a fruit.
Has a like a little,
yeah,
also like thyme tincture. So it brings a little bit of like the herbaceous.
And that's a good way, I think, to wrap our segment with this wonder. And tell us what this drink is again.
This is it's called Loveless. And it's going to be on A-Bar on two Thursday. So
this week only.
This week only.
Well, I love Loveless.
Mm-hmm. Well, Damian and Diego Longarica, they are bartenders in Philadelphia. Thanks both for joining us today and for bringing us drinks. That is making our Tuesday stand out.
Thank you guys for having us.
Thank you so much.
So they can check you out, Diego, at A-Bar, and you,
at Irwin's.
Damian, at say one more time?
Irwin's in the back building.
Thank you so much. And that's it for our show today. It's been great hanging out with you, Matt.
Yeah, this has been fun, Cherry. Let's do it again.
Yes. I want to say thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder and Andreas Copes. Al Banks is our engineer from Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Matt Gillum. Happy to be here with you for the week.